America Trends Podcast is part of the MHNR Network. MHNRnetwork.com.
What you're about to experience is one man's quest to see beyond the tumultuous period we're in and to envision what lies just beyond our grasp, yet well within our reach. Welcome to Larry Rifkin's America Trends, where the future has arrived, and it's just in time.
Hi, I'm Larry Rifkin, and welcome back to America Trends. It seems not a week goes by without hearing about another cyber hack of this institution or that. It's becoming so commonplace that we barely blink an eye when staggering amounts of data, maybe our own, are now in the hands of unsavory characters around the world. What are they going to do with it? A few months of free security monitoring can't be our only solution. So how do we try to blunt these intercepts of our personal information going forward? Today we'll discuss the huge SolarWinds hack, presumably by the Russians. And we'll also talk about it in the context of how this growing menace to our privacy and safety is becoming more brazen. You'll want to hear this discussion today on America Trends.
With me on America Trends is an old friend, somebody we've had on the program before, Frederick Scholl, and he is the director of the cybersecurity program at Quinnipiac University. We'll talk more about that program later on because maybe you'll be so intrigued by the conversation that you might want to go back and get a degree in this, because there's been a lot of attention, Fred, drawn to this issue of cybersecurity. And we all know about it in our own personal lives. I want to start, though, with the government. And there was this massive computer breach that allowed hackers to spend months exploring a lot of government networks and private company systems around the world. And we are told that it was the Russians. My first question is, how do we know it was the Russians?
I'm not sure if you 100% know exactly who it is, but there are people in law enforcement and Department of Homeland Security and agencies within the government and private industry. So they're out monitoring the dark web and they're monitoring traffic constantly. It's called threat intelligence. So there's a whole segment of the security industry devoted to monitoring what's going on out there. So based on all those data points, they're going to attribute it to Russia or China or whoever it might be. There's never a 100% guarantee because any perpetrator or hacker or state-sponsored attacker can always launch the attack from another country, another server, another network. So it's a difficult field to get 100% attribution. So I'm sure they're looking at a bunch of different data points that they've collected from around the world with sensors that are out there.
Do we leave a certain mark when somebody goes in to hack? Are there certain fingerprints, if you will?
Well, they do leave fingerprints. So there are human beings at the other end of these attacks that are creating code, and they're writing that code in certain styles that they use. They're, you know, it's like you can, like an author of a book, right? If you are a composer of a symphony, you listen to that, there's going to be certain fingerprints in there. The same thing down at the code level. People that are writing code use the same techniques that they've used before. So they can, we've had the FBI has, we've indicted specific people in China and Russia for activities. So they can be, the good news is that we can eventually go back and follow these fingerprints as you're talking about and actually figure out to a high degree of certainty who did what.
What was really scary about this was how long they were there and how many places they intruded upon. And I was reading in one article that the Russian hack was discovered by accident when an employee at a compromised company saw the company's credentials had been used to log in to the company's network from an unrecognized device. That doesn't sound like cybersecurity experts were really on the job. It was almost fortuitous that we found what was going on.
Yes, I agree. So it's disconcerting that it wasn't, at least from what I read in the open, newspaper, multiple government agencies were affected by this particular hack. So it is disturbing that, with all the funds that the government has, and they have set up sensors, intrusion detection systems. Einstein 2 is one of the sort of code names that's been used. So it's disturbing that they're not picking up these fingerprints, as you said, in advance and triggering alarms that, should have gone off. So if it was just a vendor that actually sent something wrong with their systems and then led to this whole thing coming undone. But yeah, it is definitely concerning.
Was it possible that we're so focused on the elections and Russian interference in the 2016 and what we purported would be 2020 interference that we took our eye off the ball here?
Possibly, but I think we've had major breaches of government systems before, even down to the NSA and the CIA. So we had, several enormous breaches that we thought were bad then. So, I don't think you can say, yes, everything. We had all our sensors in place and then we just stopped looking for third-party breaches because we were looking at, for Russian hackers that were attacking the election. I don't think that's a particularly acceptable line of reasoning. These, we've had years to set up the right kinds of sensors and look for these attacks. So they should be, part and parcel of the baseline intrusion detection capability.
What about the points of access? Because undetected, these Russian hackers, if we accept that, penetrated SolarWinds, a company that produces network management software for Fortune 500 companies and government agencies. In other words, how many points of access do we need to be looking at? Not only the agencies themselves, but the companies that we contract with. And how difficult a task is that?
Yes, it's difficult because the way to envision this is that maybe you can think of it like a leak in a dam or something like that. So all you need is one tiny hole or breach point, and that's what these attackers are looking at. They're not looking for open doors, which, the doors have been sealed up. They're looking for cracks in the windows and things of that nature, and all they have to do is get one tiny piece of code, almost invisible piece of code, onto a system in the target that they're going after. And then that code then reaches back out to the so-called command and control servers that are out, wherever they could be. They could be in the U.S., they could be in another country. And once that command and control channel is set up, then the attackers can move around so-called lateral motion into other parts of the organization and look for assets that they want. So there are many different access points that these people can use. But, we know about this. We had, you recall, the OPM breach where personal records were stolen years ago. So we've had warnings about this. So that's one thing that's of concern to me.
Well, what's concerning to me is that this is happening all the time. And we know that when it's not happening, it's being attempted. I know I saw for the state of Connecticut, you and I both share that residence, that in fact, there are about 1 million attempts every day to reach into different government agencies and pull out, extract some information about you, me, or someone else. And it's just constant. And I just wonder about the defenses and the offensive capabilities and who's really ahead in this game.
Yeah, so I think it's kind of a tie between the defenders and the attackers, but the attackers can they have the advantage of offense, right? They can throw in a trick play like SolarWinds. They can come up with new approaches, and we're always playing catch up. I've done some research on root cause analysis of breaches, and when you get down to it, you see that there's always a human component and a technology component. So you can't blame the technology, or, you know, you can't blame the people either, individually. So there's usually some combination there. And of course, I'm in the education business, but I think especially for government, one of the biggest missing links is that we need to make the average or the typical employee more savvy around cybersecurity. We can't just be relying on this so-called, you know, cadre of technical security experts. Because I have actually, before I came to Quinnipiac 2 years ago, I did work for a year in a government agency, actually Health and Human Services. And so I was very impressed with the people, their capability, their commitment to the mission, which is protecting citizens' information. Things are happening anyway. So I think that we need to do more on educating the broader population. And that's also one of the NIST, the National Institute of Science and Technology, is they're the biggest standard setter for cybersecurity best practices and every other kind of standard. And this is one of their mantras. Cybersecurity is everyone's job. And so I think we need to get that message out. And, you know, that's one of the things, not to mention my program, but we're trying to enable people in different fields or from different backgrounds to get into the cybersecurity area. And I think that's one of the things that will help.
It's interesting. In the case of what happened here, we're often told you've got to update your software. There are patches that you're going to be given that improve upon the functioning of the various programs. And so that's what all of these clients did. They took the software update from this company, SolarWinds, and then it acted like a super spreader. I mean, it was really pretty ingenious the way they attached this computer virus to an update. So how do we know, individuals who aren't that savvy about all of this, that we're actually updating our computer and not letting in a virus? How do we all try to understand this stuff? It seems so amorphous to the average person.
Yes, I agree. And in the case of like the SolarWinds attack that you were just talking about, security is about belt and suspenders. And lawyers use this concept, right? You need belt and suspenders and more. It's defense in depth. So if someone corrupts a software update, and that's happened before with ransomware attacks. So again, that's not new. There needs to be other defenses. But for you and me sitting at home, you're absolutely right. So it could happen. You need to, you know, use reliable software firms as much as you can, and make sure. So I have an offline backup of all of my information. So if it gets corrupted, the most I'm going to lose is a few days or a week's work, something like that. But it you know, nobody's 100% safe. You're right.
You think about it, Fred. What happens in all these cases, we read about it, you know, this bank, this huge institution, you get a notice from LifeLock or another group that you might be subscribing to, and you're told, sorry, but there's been this breach. And then you don't really hear a lot. And so I'm really wondering what really happens to all this information that is taken, because apparently a lot of young people who live their entire lives online have no paper backups of any sort, and they go on with their lives unconcerned about what's happened.
So what's happening is all this information does go out there. It gets sold in the dark web or exchanged in the dark web from attackers or people who are then coming after vulnerable, you know, segments of the population that are vulnerable through social media, through phishing attacks, through voice attacks. And so they might not be going after you today. Another group might be going after you later. And so my concern is that we have had a lot of these breaches, that data's out there. And I think it may take some time. You know, we've had breaches from Russia and from China in the OPM breach. So nobody knows 100% where all this data is going. But I think there are, you know, really powerful artificial intelligence tools and business analytics tools. So if somebody gets that data, they would be able to use it in the future for, you know, maybe more significant attacks. So you don't want to lose all your mission critical data and personal information, because it's not going to end well. It may not be turned around immediately the next day in an attack that you're going to see, but somebody's out there looking for ways to cause havoc either at the nation state level or the individual level. So I'm pretty worried about it. I think we need to do more to protect our systems. And I think education is one of them. The government, so just to mention, there was a commission last year called the Solarium Commission at the federal government level. They studied all these challenges. They came up with like 50 things that the government should do to improve cybersecurity, and 26 of them apparently have been adopted into legislation at the end of last year. And the good news that I just recently went to the Solarium Commission webpage, and I was impressed that they decided to extend the committee. They didn't just say, okay, we're done. It's December 2020. We're all done. The problems are all solved. They decided to continue the committee in operation to look at kind of the follow-on and is this stuff working. So I thought that was at least a little bit of, you know, one bright ray of sunshine in fixing these problems, at least at the federal government level.
So are you saying that if we get a notice from our bank and they say, we'll give you a year's protection, or we'll do this, that, and the other, that's not the end of the story. The story could go on, and you might find that there are some downside risks way down the road.
Yes, that's what worries me, and it's kind of like environmental problems. It's not something that affects you tomorrow, but it could affect you big time later on. So it's like the tragedy of the commons, right? We're losing all this information. And I think it could, you know, where did all this information go in this SolarWinds attack? We don't know. We don't know who's going to use it. But I think it's a, you know, national challenge to fix these problems, even though an individual sitting in your office or home, you might not immediately see the negative effect of that.
The U.S. Cybersecurity and Infrastructure Security Agency, they were pretty ominous in their warning, saying that this hack that we started the conversation about on U.S. government and tech companies poses a grave risk to federal, state, and local governments, as well as private companies and organizations. Play that out for us, because I think the problem with this is that, again, sometimes we hear about it and we don't see any immediate effect on our lives. Let's be honest, if they attacked an electrical grid, we would feel that. If we all went into darkness and were plunged there for 3 months, we would know it. And we are told that those are the types of systems that have some vulnerability, though we have a patchwork in the United States. They might not be able to affect the entire grid, but they could certainly take us out on the East Coast, for example.
Yeah, you mentioned a couple of interesting points there. So we just had this snowstorm. People don't realize how vulnerable all of our systems like the electric grid are. There's an interesting book written a few years ago about a cyber attack that was launched during a heavy snowstorm. And it doesn't take that many things to knock out to really affect these systems and cause havoc with people. And then the other thing you mentioned that was interesting is you mentioned the word risk coming out of, I believe, Department of Homeland Security. So I'll just mention something that's of concern to me is that it's up to the government to educate the citizens on what risks we have and do an effective job of that, right? And I think Homeland Security is supposed to do that every 4 years. And I teach students about risk, all kinds of risks, cyber risks, other risks. So the last time DHS did this was in 2014. They're supposed to issue a risk review for the country every 4 years. They haven't done it. So I'm concerned that the people in the federal government might be good at being reactive, but perhaps aren't as effective as they need to be in terms of being proactive. And at least my opinion is that showed up in the pandemic response. It showed up in the capital response. So cyber is one of those areas where you need to think proactively. You can't, because once hackers get in and take information, you're not getting it back.
So what should the government, if in fact they were being proactive and giving us this information on the front end, what would they be saying in your view, or should be saying?
Well, what should be said, again, there's this, you can go to the Department of Homeland Security, you can look up quadrennial security risk. What needs to be communicated is what are the leading risks that the country faces, and every country does this. So they all post, you know, they create these reports. It should be talking about what cyber risks we are facing. And it's a little bit of politically difficult, right? Because do you say something about China or Russia? So that's my theory. I've actually reached out to our senators, my congressmen. I have not gotten any response. I reached out to the undersecretary who's supposedly should be writing this report. I never got a response. So it's just endemic of possibly not enough vision around risk for cyber or other kinds of risk. And I think the people I've met in government are all very capable. I think in the cyber area, we need more education of people that are just not in the cyber silo itself, but make the risks more, make more people aware of the risks and what to do about it.
Are we engaged in a worldwide cyber war, another form of a Cold War? I mean, I guess it's better than bullets flying, but if we are, what do you worry most about? What keeps you up at night? Is it the Russian threat, the Chinese threat, the threat that they are going to go after very vital services that we all rely upon, our water system? What worries you the most?
Yeah, I think I because I've known people, you know, that hold conferences on cyber war and things like that. And until a couple of years ago, I thought it was more like fear mongering and stuff like that. But now I think, I would say we are in a cyber war with other nation states that are out there. And yes, it's better than a shooting war, but it's in the long term, it's pretty dangerous. I think I'm concerned about and have been concerned for a long time about loss of intellectual property and competitiveness. That affects our standing in the world. And then the other thing is social disruption, which we've seen in disinformation and political campaigns. This is equally dangerous. So we need to educate. So I see that as part of cybersecurity. It's we defend confidentiality of information, availability, and also integrity. So if fake information is going up there, that's getting posted, that's something that security professionals need to worry about. And actually, a couple of years ago, there was a very good talk from a guy named Alex Stamos. He used to be the chief information security officer of Facebook. And he said, he was like ahead of the curve 2 or 3 years ago. He said, this is my biggest security risk that I face is false information getting posted on my website. And so he was certainly right about that.
Frederick Scholl is with us, and he is the Cybersecurity Program Director at Quinnipiac University. Let me ask you to react to something Arthur House wrote. He is a principal of Cybersecurity Risk Associates. He had been in the office of the Director of National Intelligence during the Obama administration. And he wrote, "Some take comfort in turning to cyber hygiene to reduce threats. Steps such as deploying the latest defensive software, conforming to security standards, anti-phishing campaigns, training and establishing air gaps to separate systems and networks from the internet, all good ideas. But the stark truth is that if a human can create and put something on a computer or the internet, a human can compromise it. No network or computer is completely secure. So how insecure should that make us feel?"
Well, that's true. So for the, you know, I agree with him on that, but for the, you know, the average person, we're not a high probability target for too many hackers out there. If you're a small business, you might not be a high probability attacker. If you're a larger business or if you're an executive, I wrote a article on what executives should do to protect themselves, business leaders, government leaders protect themselves at home. They should take other steps. What you need to do is set up your system or your home office or your company to be what's called resilient. We kind of have to agree with what he said. There, people are going to break in. Okay. So resilient means that they don't get everything that they're looking for. So it's the same as, you know, if you have a home, do you have certain parts of it sectioned off? Do you have internal locks? Maybe that's not such a good example, but you don't want to have the entire space open if somebody gets in through one crack in the window. So you have, it's minimizing what gets stolen. I think he's right. You can't totally prevent people from getting in, but you need to set up internal barriers so that you can catch them when they do get in. Because so security is all about time. So if somebody gets in the crack in the window, you need to have a system that identifies that fast enough before they get to, you know, the safe or something like that. So that's what security is. So as he says, given enough time and resources, somebody's will be able to get into any system you set up. So that means you have to have a fast enough detection system so that they don't get, you know, everything that they're looking for. You've got to minimize what they do get, if anything.
How do we know that we or a company or the government has really put in place attempt to at least blunt, if not block, and at least slow down, if not to impede? How do we know we've got that? For example, even on our own personal computers.
Well, on our own personal computers, and I'm actually working to write up some of this. So maybe if I get a chance to come back on your show, I can kind of document the answer to that question, because there's a bunch of different things. So there, Microsoft Windows has a number of settings, for example, that don't allow unknown programs to run. You've probably seen those. They're kind of annoying, right? You try to run some new program and you get a pop-up and it says, oh, I can't run this program. But those things are, they're a number of different things you can do that will secure your home system. And at the government level, again, the DHS is responsible for this risk report. We should be able to read that and get accurate information. So this Solarium Commission that I mentioned, it had 26 recommendations that were put into law at the end of last year. So the president is expected in the next day or two, I believe, to nominate somebody in his executive office to be responsible for cybersecurity at the federal government level. If we have that person, hopefully there will be better communication out to the rest of us, and we'll be able to have more say, at least to elected officials, in what's going on.
I know that you're a thought leader in this entire area. I guess one of the questions is, have we prioritized those things that we really do want to protect against a cyber attack, things that, again, would be very noticeable to us as a community, as a society, like the delivery of electricity or, our water system? Do you think those digital pathways to these processes have really been paid enough attention?
No, that's a good question. And I think, at least I've only been in Connecticut a couple of years, and I know people like Art House, you mentioned, and others are. I know we have a very good new chief information security officer in the state. So I know these people are focusing on doing the best job that they can to secure assets, whether it's state-level assets or federal assets or electric grids, water systems, stuff like that. But what you're talking about is called enterprise risk management. You're looking at the big picture. what are the things we need to protect, and are we putting sufficient funds and assets to protect those? And actually, this is one of the kind of unsolved problems in cybersecurity that we need to work on. How do you take the cyber risks? They're explained often in terms of bits and bytes. How do you translate that into the whole field of enterprise risk? So we look at all of these risks holistically and figure out, are we spending the right amount on cyber or not? And so right now it's not really an exact science. And I think a lot more work needs to be done to make the people in charge, your governors and et cetera, make them understand what are the risks, and you have to explain it in the language that they understand. So we're not there yet.
As Americans, sometimes we think we're always the victim, and yet we have used offensive cyber capabilities ourselves around the world, so we're no shrinking violet in this game either. But what is the response that is commensurate with the attack that you and I started this conversation talking about, when we're talking about so many agencies and major ones that have an impact on our lives, our security? What's the proper response?
Yeah, that's an excellent question and subject for debate. And I think I would like to see the response focus on our defenses and do a better job on defenses and do a better job on intelligence gathering in, around the world. There's something amiss that we didn't know in advance that this was going on. So I think and it's human intelligence and cyber intelligence. I personally, some people say we ought to respond in kind and launch more attacks against other people. I'm concerned about that. I don't think that goes anywhere. This kind of escalation isn't going to help us, but we definitely need better human and cyber intelligence around the world to know that these attacks are being planned, right? Because this was a very sophisticated attack, as you said, Larry, and it had been under development for months. And the people that are developing it are not all sitting in one room in any particular country. The nature of attack development, it's being done by multiple software development groups scattered around the world. So we apparently missed the boat on understanding that this was happening until it actually did happen.
It all sounds to me like we need a lot more people, not only at the operational level, but the folks who are thinking about this all the time. And again, we're putting it back on you, IT specialists. But you've got a program at Quinnipiac preparing people to go out into this field. Are we doing enough in the educational realm, not only to educate individuals, as we were talking about earlier, the government saying, hey, these are the risks that we all are going to bear in this digital age, but are we really getting enough professionals into the field to deal with this? Because computers, they are part of our everyday existence in every transaction these days. There's nothing that is exempt from it.
Our program at Quinnipiac is we've been focused on bringing people from other fields, not just information technology. So we have even one student who's a political science major. He's really interested in making sure data is secure at the state level. We have several students from the criminal justice background. So we also have traditional students from information technology and computer science programs and things like that. But the message I'm trying to get out is that you don't have to be a hardcore tech person to go into this field and make good contributions. And I think one thing we could do more of, and I'm hoping that we can at Quinnipiac and other places, is really reach out to people at the community college level and get them into accelerated programs that would end up in degrees in cybersecurity. So we've done that in the coding industry in New Haven and other places. There are schools that will get you a jump start in being able to do Python coding or Java coding or something like that, because these schools know that there are jobs out there, right? If you can code, you can go out and get a good job really quickly. And I think the same thing is true of cybersecurity. So maybe we've created too big a barrier or something, or maybe we need to see, I think we need to figure out ways to accelerate the learning for people that, you know, might not be thinking about this program, or they might, you know, I think there are good jobs out there. So we need to figure out how to accelerate learning for people that, you know, want to get into the field. So we're trying to do that. And I think others are too.
I would imagine. I mean, this can't be a field that you're ever going to run out of work, you know, trying to pursue,
yeah.
Because there are all kinds of folks out there trying to break into every system imaginable. Even during the 30 minutes we've been together, Fred, I can't imagine how many intrusions were attempted. Well, listen, I hope I didn't intrude on your time today. If somebody wants to find out more about your program, how can they do that?
Go to our website. So our program is online. It's 30 credit hours. It's master's degree level. And you can just look at quonline.qu.edu, and that will take you to the program, or Google my name and reach out to me, and happy to talk to anybody or chat with people who need some advice on this field.
Okay, and tell them that you heard him on America Trends podcast. Once again, our guest, Frederick Scholl, just a privilege to have you on with us again, and thanks so much for sharing your knowledge with my audience.
Thank you, Larry. So much fun to be on. Appreciate it.